WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Now that President Clinton has delivered his health care plan to Congress, the debate is entering a new phase. On today's Fresh Air, how do we evaluate this complicated plan and the effects it will have on our health and our finances? We'll talk with Mark Roberts, author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. Roberts is on the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health. That's coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Firefighters say that calmer winds and cooler temperatures are helping them battle more than a dozen wildfires that are burning across 113,000 acres of Southern California. Almost 600 houses have been burned and some 30,000 people have been forced to flee. Authorities said that human injuries were remarkably low for a disaster of such magnitude. 29 firefighters were injured, three of them critically. No more than a dozen civilians were hurt, and there were no reports of deaths. The day after presenting his legislative package on health care reform to Congress, President and Mrs. Clinton hit the campaign trail to win support for their plan. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
The president and first lady went to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, where they asked a gathering of mostly physicians and medical students to support their effort to reform the health care system. The president said that doctors and health care providers had been intimately involved in the development of the plan, and he said it's critical that the problems in the health care system be solved soon.
This is a very important thing. On its own merits, it ought to be done. In any age and time, with this set of problems and this set of opportunities in healthcare, somebody should be willing to act. At this time, it is critical for America to get in the shape we need to be in by the beginning of the next century so we can do what we have to do as a country.
The president's reform plan is now in Congress, where President Clinton predicts a vigorous debate, but he emphasizes that his bottom line remains health benefits for all Americans. I'm Patricia Naimond reporting.
Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has urged the United Nations to impose a comprehensive trade embargo on Haiti. At the same time, he asked current Prime Minister Robert Malval to remain in office despite his threats to resign by the end of this month. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
While Aristide spoke of the need for reconciliation in Haiti, he also stressed the need to remain firm and allow for international sanctions to take effect. Sanctions that now include an oil and arms embargo. Speaking through an interpreter, Aristide said he wants to see the sanctions broadened even further so that no commercial goods enter Haiti and the military rulers are forced to comply with the political agreement signed last July on Governor's Island in New York.
We request a total and complete blockade, which is necessary, nay, even essential.
In a small gesture of conciliation, Aristide said he's prepared to have Parliament declare a total amnesty as the leaders of the army and police have been demanding. But he laid out a condition. Such a measure would not take place until these leaders resign. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
The Dow Industrials gained more than 23 points today to close at a record 3,688. This is NPR News in Washington. The chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee, Senator Richard Bryan, said today that the panel voted to subpoena Senator Bob Packwood's diaries. The action came after an initial inspection raised questions about possible criminal violations. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Bryan said the possible criminal conduct involved matters not related to allegations of sexual misconduct and intimidation of witnesses that the Ethics Committee has been investigating for the last 10 months. Bryan said the existence of the diaries was first revealed by Packwood himself, that the Oregon senator used the diaries in his own defense when he answered questions under oath behind closed doors in early October. Bryan said the committee then asked to see the diaries and Packwood agreed. The chairman said that Packwood and the committee staff went through some 5,000 pages of diaries without incident, and that it was only when the committee staff discovered information raising questions of possible criminal conduct that Packwood suddenly called a halt to the review and reneged on the agreement. After Bryan's statement was issued, Senator Bob Dole, the Republican leader, took to the Senate floor to call the statement unfortunate and demanding that Bryan and the Ethics Committee file a formal charge against Packwood to back up the allegation of possible criminal wrongdoing. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
For the first time in 4 years, the federal budget deficit has declined. The Treasury Department says the deficit for fiscal 1993 was down by more than 12% from last year's record of $290.3 billion. It was also nearly 21% under the administration's prediction last April that the deficit would hit $322 billion. President Clinton claimed credit for the improvement, but private economists said that much of it came about because of factors beyond his control. Part of it was because of lower interest rates, and part because Congress failed to provide $15 billion for the savings and loan cleanup. Another $11 billion was saved by the fact that Congress rejected the president's economic stimulus package. This is NPR News.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who's got the time to read the president's 1,342-page health care plan, which he just delivered to Congress? You probably don't have the time. So we're going to try to make sense of the plan and of the problems it's intended to solve. My guest Mark Roberts is the author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. He's a professor of health policy and political economy and serves on the faculty of Harvard School of Public Health and John F. Kennedy School of Government. Let's start with the basics of the Clinton health care plan.
The Clinton plan, I think, has four basic components. The president wants to, first of all, reform the insurance market, and he wants to do that by making sure that everybody has a choice among insurance plans. And so the idea is that, in a sense, we're going to turn the health insurance market from a wholesale market, where your employer buys your insurance for you, into a retail market, where each individual will have a choice of a number of insurance plans. The second thing he wants to do is make sure that the prices for those plans don't vary with individuals' health status. He wants to have what's called community rating, so that sick and well people will pay the same rate. And he also wants to do away with the current practice whereby if you're already sick, you often can't buy insurance. So he wants to have this an end to what's called an exclusion for pre-existing conditions. In order to make sure that everybody can then shop for insurance, the third big component of the system is to have both an employer and an individual mandate. Essentially, everybody's going to have to buy insurance. If they're employed, their employer is going to have to pay. And if they're not employed, they're going to have to pay themselves. Now, since a lot of people won't be able to afford it, the employer plus individual mandate is combined with an elaborate set of subsidies to make sure that everybody will be able to afford participating in this new competitive insurance market. And then finally, he wants to wrap some sort of global budgetary cap around the whole system to make sure that the thing doesn't go out of control. So the essential idea is a reform of the insurance market and universal coverage through this joint employer-individual mandate.
Now, my understanding has been that there'll be three basic types of plans. One would be your HMO. One would be fee-for-service, where you could choose any doctor, but there'd be a fee for each doctor visit. And the third would be some kind of middle ground between
right.
the two.
The Clinton plan says that they hope that that's what will be available in each area. But what happens if one or another of the kinds of plans is simply not represented in the market area? There's no guarantee that it will appear.
So it's possible that in one area you won't have a choice of an HMO, in another area you won't have a choice of a fee-for-service?
Exactly. Because suppose there is no HMO in the area. There's nothing in the Clinton proposal that will guarantee that an HMO will suddenly spring into existence. And similarly, in some parts of the country, it seems quite likely that no insurance company is enthusiastic about offering the pure fee-for-service option. In some ways, that's been so difficult to manage that it's quite possible that that would not appear. It's because of that contingency, actually, that Representative Pete Stark has been saying that he wants to preserve Medicare, which, after all, is essentially a fee-for-service plan, and make Medicare available as the fee-for-service insurance plan in different parts of the country. It remains to be seen whether or not that idea survives the legislative process.
Of course, along with that, some people are worried that that would present a two-tier system and that senior citizens would get inferior health care because in many instances the Clinton plan would offer a little bit more than Medicare does.
Yeah, it's really been interesting to observe the evolution of the lobbying on this. One of the problems with the president's approach has been because he's not really sketched very much in the way of principles around which to build his plan, he doesn't have a basis really for telling us which compromises he'll accept and which he'll reject. And this leaves him open to a lot of lobbying pressure. The senior citizens, for example, started out insisting that they did not want to be part of these alliances, that they were very happy with Medicare, that it worked well, that they were able to protect it congressionally, and they really wanted to be left out of the system. When the benefit package came out and turned out that in some respects was superior to the Medicare benefit package, now they suddenly want to be in the system. Actually, what they want is they want the Medicare benefit package to be enriched up to the level of the basic benefit package, but still to be outside the system. They really want the best of both worlds. And with such an elaborate plan, George Bernard Shaw once said that being reviewed by the London theater critics was being nibbled to death by ducks. And I think that the president is going to find that Bob Dole and the drug manufacturers and these other people who are going to be nibbling on the 1,600 pages for the next 6 months are substantially more voracious than mere ducks.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Roberts, and he's a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, and he's the author of the new book, The Healthcare Crisis Explained, Your Money or Your Life. Let's look at the unfolding debate now that the bill is before Congress. Let's look at some of the interest groups involved here and analyze what their interests are. Why don't we start with the insurance industry? What's in it for them in this debate? What are they looking for? What are they pressing for?
Yeah, the situation of the insurance industry is really amusing because the insurance industry has divided. A group of the very largest health insurance companies have broken off from the Health Insurance Association of America and formed their own lobbying group called the Alliance for Managed Competition. They've broken off because they like the president's plan. They feel that they're going to be able to go into a lot of local market areas, construct these networks, and be listed as eligible plans by the alliances, and that their market share is going to go up because they have the deep pockets and the marketing skills and the organizational skills to take advantage of the new situation. On the other hand, many of the smaller health insurance companies have been opposed to the Clinton plan simply because it represents such a radical reorganization of the insurance market. Both of these reactions, but particularly the opposition of the smaller companies, is very amusing to a lot of observers and health economists because the other alternative that the administration rejected would have been to have gone to a Canadian-style single-payer plan, which would have done away with the health insurance market entirely. And so in some sense, when the Health Insurance Association blasts the Clinton plan, they are really biting the hand that feeds them. They're really going after the president, who is trying to preserve a role for private insurance in a world in which, in almost every country, there is no role for private insurance. And so in some sense, it's sort of ironic that the man who's trying to save the private insurance industry turns out to be the target for these TV ads that are vilifying him. What the insurance companies really want in this context is self-preservation. The reason why the Canadians were able to do what they did was, in some sense, they drowned the kitten of the health insurance industry when it was still quite small in the 1960s. And those kittens have grown up to be a set of pretty powerful political tigers, and it's going to be much more difficult to control them now that we've had almost 30 years of political history that's contributed to the growth of the industry.
Do you think doctors are split on the Clinton health care plan also?
Doctors are very split, and as I go around the country and talk to medical groups, I get two different reactions. First of all, let's understand that doctors vary enormously in their circumstances as well as in their ideology. Some physicians are in independent community practice. Some are working in medical centers. A lot are now already working in HMOs. Some do a lot of soft medicine. They do a lot of talking to patients. They're pediatricians or family care physicians. Others are surgeons and at the high-tech end of the spectrum. And so this is a pretty heterogeneous community of about 1.5 million individuals. Many of the physicians who within the medical community are referred to as the high rollers. This means people who admit a lot of patients to hospitals, who do a lot of procedures and make very substantial incomes. Those people tend to be highly opposed to the plan because on ideological grounds and also personal income grounds, they don't want anybody monkeying around with their income streams and their autonomy. Interestingly enough, some of the healthcare organizations are in favor not only of the Clinton plan, but some have even argued in favor of single-payer Canadian-style plans, because what they really want is to be left alone, to have the autonomy to practice in the way that they want to practice. So really, what the problem the AMA faces, and the AMA now only represents a minority of all American physicians, is that it's dealing with a pretty divided constituency, just like the health insurance industry is pretty divided. The problem with both of these groups, however, is that the one thing that their members can agree upon, in a sense, is that there are some features of the current plan they don't like. Now, different people dislike different features of the current plan, but it raises the possibility of sort of a negative coalition. A plan that's 1,600 pages long has something in it that makes almost everybody aggravated. And so if everybody who's aggravated at some feature of the plan opposes it, then almost everybody will oppose it, and maybe for highly inconsistent and different reasons. And that'll mean the president will have very tough sledding ahead.
What do you think are the most important criteria consumers should use in evaluating the Clinton health care plan?
Well, I think there are three things that people have to bear in mind. And let me say, if I might, I'd even disagree with the form of the question. Because to say that the way individuals should think about this is as consumers suggests that we all ought to think about this in terms of what's in it for us. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's wrong. I really think that the kind of society we live in, the kind of relationships we have, the kind of community we are, is defined in part by the healthcare system. I mean, after all, the healthcare system is 14% of the gross domestic product. It's also, in some ways, the deepest expression of our social values. And I think I would urge our listeners to think about this problem not from the point of view only of what's in it for them, that's legitimate, but also what kind of America do they want? As a citizen as well as a consumer, what kind of plan do they want to emerge from all this? And as I said, I think there are three things that as citizens as well as consumers, people ought to think about. The first thing is, will the coverage be genuinely universal? Will everybody really be in? We are the only country in the world in which some people in our nation go to bed at night worrying about the trade-off between their money and their life. That's why we titled the book the way we did. And in some sense, it's really profoundly discouraging to think that in the richest country in the world, there are people who are trying to decide whether to spend money on a needed operation or on shoes for the kids to get them through the winter. And I really think we need to think about having a genuinely universal and affordable system. And I really applaud the president for constantly coming back to that theme.
What's your second criteria?
Second criteria, I'd say, is will we really control cost? Are the cost controls really going to be in there? We spend 60 to 100% more than every other major industrial country in the world. Our life expectancy is no longer. Our rate of physician visits is lower. Our rate of hospital care is lower. Our infant mortality is higher. Our rate of immunization is lower. Our immunization rate's down around Panama and Bulgaria. And really, we can't get universality unless we have cost control. Because if the costs go out of control, the first thing we'll do is pull back on the universality. And also, we need the cost control in order to free resources up for other parts of the public agenda for employment and crime fighting and so on. And the third criteria, it seems to me, that that people ought to think about is choice. Just how free are they going to be able to be in the system to maintain the relationships with the physicians that they care about, and when they're unhappy with the kind of care that they're receiving, to go somewhere else.
Mark Roberts is the author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life: The Healthcare Crisis Explained. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I think it's fair to say that we're all concerned about the future of our health care and confused by the complexities of the Clinton proposal. That's why we asked Mark Roberts to help us understand the plan and the debate about it. On public radio, we have the time to go into depth, and we don't patronize our listeners. You need public radio to help make sense of the present and plan for the future. I want you to help keep Fresh Air and the station healthy so that we can be there for you. Please call with a pledge. Thank you for all the support you've shown. Our format is a bit different than usual this week because many public radio stations around the country are fundraising and are taking breaks within our program. For those of you hearing the show uninterrupted, we're featuring a series of performances from our archives. Contemporary singers in the know have been adding the songs of David Frischberg to their repertoires. The jazz critic Mike Joyce once wrote that Frischberg writes the kind of songs that Johnny Mercer and Woody Allen might have come up with had they ever collaborated. In 1991, Frischberg performed some of his songs in our studio. Dave Frischberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
You've brought a brand new song with you, and I'd love to hear it.
Okay, great. I'd like to do it for you. I'll be late getting home from the office, and so will you, 'cause we both got a million calls to return and a million things to do. We're not seeing enough of each other, 'cause truth be told, we're up to our ears in our careers, and we're putting our hearts on hold. So darling, let me bring you up to speed. A little time together's what we need. Quality time. We both deserve a little quality time. We'll find a small hotel, remote and quiet. In case they want to sell, my firm could buy it. Then we develop it and gentrify it. We're talking quality time. Quality time. We owe ourselves a little quality time. In the Bahamas, we can let our stress go. We'll walk along the beach and dine al fresco. I'll take a power lunch with Robert Vesco. We're talking quality time. Come fly with me. Unwind, kick back, relax. I'll bring my laptop fax. You'll work on your new screenplay. I'll update my resume. Quality time, a little frolic and frivolity time. We'll take a seminar on self-hypnosis so we can learn to stop and smell the roses. We'll do a workshop on the grieving process. Learning to cry is no crime. We're talking quality time. Hit the tennis courts in our Adidas. Some influential sorts are bound to meet us. We'll play it smart, of course, and let them beat us. We're talking quality time. We'll we'll find some upscale friends to share some space with, a wealthy couple we can interface with, a smart attorney we could start a case with. We're talking quality time. Come dine with me. This time you choose the wine. Romance is the bottom line. And later, when we're alone, hang on, there's my other phone. We'll have a ball, but now I got to deal with this other call. We both been chewing more than we can bite off. We got to take at least a day and night off. I'll speak to Sid, he'll make it all a write-off. This may not cost us a dime. I'll fax you back with a plan of attack to let the quality time begin. We'll lock in the time frame, and you can pencil me in. Better pencil me in.
I love it.
Oh, thank you.
That's a great new song. You know, you do something that Cole Porter used to do, which is like incorporate like proper nouns, you know, like names of people from the people writing the song.
Right.
Oh, that's a really funny song. You've gotten in everything.
That's my job.
Well, I think composers like you have a way of kind of putting across a song and of putting a certain kind of the right emotion, whether it's wit or sentiment. Do you know what I mean? Just kind of striking the right emotion in the way you're performing it.
If there's any technique to what I do as far as accompanying myself, I think it might lie in the fact that a lot of times I sing to silence. I stop playing when I sing certain songs, especially up-tempo jazz things, and I leave open spaces for my voice to execute the music. And then I hear other singers trying to do some of my up-tempo songs, and I wonder why it sounds cluttered, and I wonder why they express difficulty. That's a hard song, you know, to get those things out. Well, then I see, the reason I'm getting it out is because instinctively I stop playing behind myself at that moment and allow the words to happen. And, of course, that doesn't occur to them because someone else is playing the piano, and it wouldn't occur to him either, you know.
What's an example of a song where you lay out like
Well,
that?
For instance, a song that like Zoot Walks In, which is full of jazz articulation, you know. Jazz is a saxophone sound. Not every player's got his own sound. Well, you see how much there was silence in back of me. So other singers try to sing this, and they got piano player playing. Jazz is a saxophone. So, you know what I mean? And they got
exactly.
All this stuff going on in back of them. Naturally, it sounds a little cluttered.
Have you ever sang with anybody else accompanying you?
Oh, only for brief hysterical moments. I sang with a full orchestra once. That was really terrifying. In California, Peter Matz was conducting, and it was a tribute to Johnny Mandel, and I was doing a Mandel song called El Cajon with a full orchestra behind me. What a panicky feeling. I sent Peter Matz the music, and he called me back on the phone. He said, don't you want to put this maybe a whole tone higher or maybe a minor third higher? I said, well, gee, I can't sing that high. He says, well, you got it in a very confidential key. And I realized that, you know, I wrote most of my keys for myself in a range that I can handle, but it is a confidential one. And when you got an orchestra in back, if you can't sing like that, you know, you can't sing. Jazz is a saxophone. You got to sing. Jazz is a saxophone. You got to do because otherwise you're not going to be heard. See, so that's terrifying to sing with a orchestra, and it's also scary to sing with another piano player. I did that a couple of times. It's like jumping out of a plane without a chute. You know?
Dave Frischberg, recorded in 1991. If you want to hear more of his work, his album Classics is on Concord Jazz. His latest album, Where You At, is on Sterling Records, which will also release his album Quality Time in January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If your child injures his foot in a soccer game and the HMO orthopedist can't see him for 3 weeks, what do you do? Coming up, we talk more with Mark Roberts about the concerns many people have about managed care, such as getting to see a specialist when you need one. Roberts is the author of the new guide, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has promised federal aid to the areas of Southern California devastated by wildfires this week. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President declared 5 California counties to be disaster areas, making them eligible for federal recovery aid. Mr. Clinton came to the Rose Garden this morning to say that his heart goes out to all the people in Southern California who've lost their homes and possessions.
Many hundreds of people on the ground are engaged in valiant efforts to fight these fires now. Neighbors are helping neighbors. We will offer what we can to help fight the fires, to meet the needs of the victims, to stand with the people who are already doing so much.
The head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, James Lee Witt, is traveling to California, and the federal government has offered Agriculture and Interior Department firefighters to help. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Less wind and cooler temperatures have aided firefighters in Southern California today. However, there are still more than 12 blazes along the coast. So far, the fires have burned nearly 100,000 acres and damaged some 600 homes. Arson is suspected in 4 of the fires. Some 6,500 people have been fighting the fires and more are expected today. Tomorrow, stronger winds are also expected again. More than 30 people have been injured and 2 firemen are listed in critical condition. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved extending unemployment compensation to jobless workers whose benefits are about to run out. But senators attached 2 amendments to the bill that will delay its arrival in the president's desk. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
After 3 days of debate, the Senate approved the measure by a vote of 76 to 20. For most senators, extending benefits for the approximately 1 million jobless Americans whose benefits will run out between now and February was not a problem. How to pay for the $1.1 billion extension was. Last night, the Senate approved an amendment keeping unemployed people who made more than $120,000 last year from getting their benefits extended. They also approved an unrelated amendment that will lock in a 250,000 employee reduction in the federal workforce proposed by the president. Neither amendment was in the benefit extension bill approved by the House, meaning it will now have to go back to that chamber for another vote. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The government says it has provided more than $207 million in aid to 9 states in the Middle West hit hard by flooding this summer. States receiving the aid are Wisconsin, North Dakota and South Dakota, Nebraska, Missouri, Minnesota, Kansas, and Iowa. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 23 points to close at 3,687.86, a record high, on volume of more than 297 million shares. Trading again today was heavy. This is NPR News. Ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has called for a total blockade and trade ban against Haiti. He also said that he will not go home again until the military leader who helped oust him from power leaves. Under an agreement signed in July with military leaders in Haiti, Aristide was to return by this Saturday. But recent violence led by military-backed groups has delayed this plan. At a news conference today in Washington, President Clinton said that the U.S. is considering other measures against the island's military rulers. And the U.S. Space Command says a Chinese satellite has made a fiery re-entry from orbit, plunging into the Pacific Ocean some 1,000 miles off the coast of Peru. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
According to the Space Command, the satellite splashed down in the ocean shortly after noon Eastern Time. It was traveling about 17,000 miles per hour when it began its descent. The U.S. Space Command has been tracking the 2-ton research satellite since it was launched on October 8th. 10 days after liftoff, ground controllers were supposed to instruct the satellite to eject an experimental capsule. But something apparently went wrong, and both the satellite and the experiment capsule began descending out of control toward Earth. A spokesman for the Space Command said the satellite's final splashdown spot wasn't certain until the last moment. That's because objects approaching Earth from space sometimes skip off the atmosphere, much like a stone skipping off water. The Chinese satellite did skip, moving it about 500 miles from the expected splashdown spot. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
The government announced today that the nation's economy expanded in the third quarter of the year by 2.8%. This growth rate came despite flooding in the Midwest and dry weather in the Southeast that destroyed billions of dollars in crops. The report was the best of the year and compared to a 1.9% increase in the second quarter of the year. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Roberts. Now that the president has delivered his health care plan to Congress, we asked Roberts to explain the plan and the problems it's intended to solve. Roberts is the author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. He's on the faculty of Harvard's School of Public Health and John F. Kennedy School of Government. HMOs are a cornerstone of the Clinton healthcare plan. One of the assumptions behind some current HMOs is that if the doctor is on salary, then he has no financial incentive to recommend unnecessary high-tech procedures. I asked Mark Roberts if the evidence shows that HMOs have saved money this way, and if they've saved money by giving patients less care than they need.
This is a very good question, and one that's very hotly debated in the literature. What we do know is that some HMOs, particularly those that fit the description you just gave, so-called staff model HMOs, where people actually are on salary, they appear to have lower costs than the fee-for-service part of the delivery system. Now, it's hard to decide how much of that cost saving is due to real operating efficiency and how much of it is due to the fact that HMOs tend to attract younger and healthier patients, because after all, people who are sick and have established relationships with doctors often don't go into the HMOs. So this is a huge statistical swamp you're leading us into about interpreting this evidence. It also depends on what question we ask. Are we asking about the level of costs or the rate of growth of costs? My own reading of the evidence suggests that the more effectively managed HMOs do have lower absolute costs, but their rates of growth have not been that much below those of the system as a whole. Ironically, some of the ones that have the best cost performance accept the premise of your question, that is, that financial incentives influence doctors' behavior even if only unconsciously, and have reversed the incentives. There are HMOs in California that give their primary care physicians very large bonuses every year based on how little use of specialist care the people under their custody actually make.
And so, let me stop you there. Isn't that exactly what frightens so many people about HMOs?
Oh, I agree. I mean, I myself would not be enthusiastic about going to a doctor who is paid more to keep me from using medical care. I don't think Henry Kissinger said even paranoids have enemies. Just because you're afraid of that doesn't mean you're wrong to be afraid of that. That's one of the reasons why there's been this protest against the enthusiasm that underlies the Clinton plan for putting everybody into managed care networks. In general, in the United States, we do too much medicine. But the question is, how can we move back from doing too much to doing the right amount and not overshoot the mark and wind up doing too little? And I myself would prefer a situation in which we limited the capacity in the system and then enlisted the physicians as, in a sense, the system's allies. We tell the physicians, well, we only have so many magnetic resonance imaging machines in the region, and you have to use the MRI capacity sparingly for those patients who really need it, rather than either pay the doctor more to use the MRI or pay to the doctor not to use the MRI. I'd rather create a system which was financially neutral and created the capacity we could afford by thinking about in advance how much of a budgetary system we had. But the Clinton plan will move us in the direction of rewarding those organizations that can bring utilization down. And we're liable to see more of that within the system. One of the ironic things about competition here is that we're importing business principles ever more fully into medical care. And the Clinton plan really relies on business principles. It really says the charitable impulse and the community solidarity impulse and the service impulse that have been an important part of American medicine. These are lost and gone forever. And what we want is a bunch of guys trained at Northwestern Business School, Wharton, and the Harvard Business School with sharp pencils running these insurance plans the same way they run automobile companies or supermarket chains. And once you do that, once you push the system toward business principles, you can get perverse decisions because they make money.
Another premise of the HMO is, I think it's fair to say that most HMOs operate with the fact that you can't see a specialist without first going to a general practitioner who serves as a kind of gatekeeper. And that general practitioner decides whether your condition merits seeing a specialist or not. Do we have any empirical evidence on how that's been working, if it saves money, if it saves money at the expense of our health?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that unlimited access to specialists both increases costs and doesn't necessarily improve health status. There are lots of studies that suggest that in an ordinary fee-for-service system, what best explains how much surgery there is in a town is how many surgeons there are. A lot of clinical decisions are very ambiguous, Terry. I'm an economist, and those of us who are outside the system are not necessarily aware how much gut judgment and intuition is involved in medical practice. And if someone's busy and has a lot to do and can't squeeze you into the schedule and you're an ambiguous case, they may decide, no, they won't operate. And if they don't have a lot to do and they have an alimony payment coming up or they want a new car or they have college tuition due and they have a morning free, maybe their intuition will be different. It's not a question even of being evil and self-seeking. It's a question of what your gut is like. And so we do know, I think, that limiting the supply of specialists lowers the use of specialists and tends to do so on average without hurting people's health status. In the United States, we have more specialists than anyone else, and we have worse health status. So that's sort of a controlled experiment.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Mark Roberts. He's a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. You tell an interesting story in your new book, Your Money or Your Life, about what happened when your son had a soccer injury and he needed some work on his foot. Your family belonged to an HMO, and you found that there was a 3-week wait to see the orthopedist on your HMO.
And I went nuts, frankly. And as I say in the book, I will leave the HMO unidentified, but I happened to know one of the members of the senior management team, and I called him from the payphone in the lobby of the HMO where my son was and explained the situation because it was a potentially quite serious injury. The point was we didn't really know what was wrong with him. And I explained the situation to this old friend who in turn got the HMO to authorize an out-of-plan referral. The problem was that the HMO, in an attempt to limit costs, didn't have many orthopedic specialists, and the orthopedic specialists were backed up, and they didn't have a good mechanism for deciding when something was sufficiently urgent that they needed a sort of escape valve from the system. And that is the risk you run. When you operate a system by limiting supply, you need to have the people who operate it be intelligent enough to know when you have someone jump the queue or not. In general, we don't today, within the HMO system, always have the management tools and the decision-making tools in place to do that effectively.
Well, what you did, as you explain in your book, is you had a friend who knew somebody in the HMO, and you pulled some strings, and your son got seen. And I think that's a fear that so many of us have about the HMO-type system, is that the people who can pull strings will get the care, and the people who can't won't get it as good.
Well, I think, unfortunately, Terry, that's true of all of American medicine today. If you look at utilization of discretionary procedures by income, the rich and the middle class get much more care than the poor and members of minority groups. People who tout the quality of the American system all the time haven't really looked at the equity, or rather the very clear inequity in access to care. Many more people in rich suburbs get artificial hips than people in inner city areas, even if there's more arthritis and more bone degeneration in the inner city areas per capita. And that's one reason why I think we need to go to a universal system, because in some sense, we need to have a system in which at least physicians get paid the same for seeing everybody. And I'm very concerned that the way the Clinton plan is going, with the creation of these separate health plans, that it could easily wind up that the sick and the poor become segregated into a sort of residual plan, and we will wind up with even worse two-tier medicine. Under the system of community rating, where everybody's insurance premium is the same, you really raise the incentives to providers to get the sick people out of their plan. And the problem is, the poor tend to be sick and the sick tend to be poor. They tend to be high-cost patients from the point of view of a provider. And so we're going to really increase the incentives in the system to avoid caring for the poor. And that's why some people would argue we really ought to go, as a matter of national responsibility, to a more unified system. The other problem is that the Clinton plan really is relying on premiums to finance the thing. And in some ways, the whole Rube Goldberg business of cross subsidies and percentage limits and a lot of the complexity of the plan comes from the fact that the president's been unwilling to bite the bullet and really proposed tax financing, which would be the much cleaner and simpler and more logical way to finance the system. But the T word is now the ultimate taboo word in politics, and he's not been willing to stand up and advocate that.
I think a lot of Americans are concerned that cost-cutting, which you've described as like an essential part of any successful healthcare program, that cost-cutting and good healthcare are kind of incompatible, that really good healthcare requires buying and spending on what you need. Mm.
This, I think, is the most pervasive mistaken assumption in American psychology, the notion that more is always better and that quality is the same as quantity. The fact of the matter is that because we have a lot of excess capacity in the system, too many surgeons, too many operating rooms, too many fancy imaging devices, and do too much care, at best, a lot of this care is simply waste. It's resources expended for no difference in outcome, and in some cases, it makes people worse off. I mean, you have to remember, every time we do exploratory surgery, every time we expose people to x-rays, every time we draw blood and put people in the hospital, we risk infection. We contribute to the overall body x-ray burden, which contributes to the cancer risk and so on. It really is possible to do too much. It's possible if you think about the relationship between the money we spend and what we get for it. It's possible, in a sense, to go over the top of the hill and start down the other side, where by spending more money, we're actually making ourselves worse off. And I think that's true in a lot of places in the system. Or at the very least, we're at the flat of the curve. We're spending money with very little benefit to our health. And we really have to start thinking of health as we think about everything else. The money we spend on healthcare comes from somewhere. It comes from our pockets. It comes from our incomes. It comes out of less money for roads and bridges and highways. And we can't afford to do everything everybody might want. We have to start thinking about health in a less anxiety-ridden and more matter-of-fact way. And when we do that, I think we'll discover there are savings to be made that either have no impact on health status, or at least such a small impact on health status for such a big cost saving, that as sensible people, we're willing to make that trade-off.
Mark Roberts, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Mark Roberts is the author of the new book, Your Money or Your Life, The Healthcare Crisis Explained. He's on the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Don't you often feel that there's just too much information you have to absorb? That's why we spend a lot of time looking for experts who can explain complicated issues without giving you a headache or putting you to sleep. That's part of what you've come to expect from Fresh Air. Right now, I need to pause and explain our situation. But don't worry, this is real easy to understand. Much of public radio's funding comes from listener support. And this is the time we've put aside to ask you as honestly and directly as we know how to do your part to pay for the service you've come to rely on. Just a few pennies a day add up to a pledge that will make a significant difference to us. Thank you very much. This week, we're featuring a series of pieces from our archives by our rock historian, Ed Ward. Today, he profiles two great but short-lived bands that each had Mexican roots, Question Mark and the Mysterians and Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
Hardly surprised when we think about the contributions Mexican Americans have made to rock and roll, and figures like Ritchie Valens from East LA or Freddie Fender from South Texas come into the conversation. But there are two other Mexican American groups you almost never hear people talk about. Neither of them is from a place that's a Hispanic stronghold, and, well, both of them are a little goofy. Take Domingo Zamudio, for instance. He was born in Dallas, but he became famous in Memphis, where he put his famous band together and recorded a song called Haunted House, which did okay locally. Then MGM Records signed them in 1965, and their first record sold 3 million copies.
Uno, dos, one, two, tres, cuatro.
It was an unforgettable record, and once people got a look at Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, as Zamudio called his band, they didn't forget them either. The group draped themselves out in phony Egyptian clothes and rode around in their hearse from show to show, thanks to the fact that one of the guys in the band had been an undertaker. Like I said, goofy. And Zamudio didn't care. It was clear from the beginning that he loved the joke, and for a while, the public did, too. They made his next record, Little Red Riding Hood, a smash.
Oh! That I see walking in these woods. Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
The band was getting better and the songs were getting funnier, but the problem is novelty groups seem to have a built-in burnout. Still, I just have to introduce you to Greenwich Grendel.
I know a chick, Grendel is her name. She's got a not a sight way out of range. She's got a mind like an IBM. But chances of loving her are mighty slim. She's Greenwich Grendel, the village queen. A rock and roll and beat the dream. She's so far out, she's in.
By 1967, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs were over, and their cleverest novelty yet only got to 54 on the charts.
Oh, that's bad!
No, that's good. Oh,
was a Shaggy Dog record to beat them all, and I still laugh at it, even though I know how it turns out. But while Sam the Sham was in decline, up in the Saginaw Valley of Michigan, 21-year-old Rudy Martinez was on his way up with his band, a bunch of young kids who were part of Michigan's large migrant worker population. In fact, it was their organist, 15-year-old Frank Rodriguez, who made this band instantly famous. Listen to this.
Teardrops for one heart to carry on. You're way on top now since you left me. You're always laughing way down at me.
Named after a particularly trashy 50s sci-fi flick, Question Mark and the Mysterians were simply bringing a sound that was very popular in central Mexico to the United States and giving it English lyrics. The cheesy Vox Jaguar organ replaced the accordion in a lot of Mexican popular music around this time, and all the Mysterians did was to play rock and roll instead of cumbias.
Hey!
It was simple. Question Mark, preferred being the Rolling Stones to being Los Tigres del Norte. But once again, the public was looking for more sophisticated things, just as the Mysterians were getting going. With their record company, the same one that had launched Chubby Checker, feeding them bad material to record, they disappeared. Today, Domingo Zamudio still lives in Memphis and was considering a Pharaoh's reunion when he found Jesus and decided not to. Question Mark and the Mysterians did reunite, but Rudy didn't want to make it permanent. They left their mark, both of them, and moved on.
Ed Ward is currently living and working in Germany. Since this piece was first broadcast, we've learned that Sam from the Pharaohs is working in the lay ministry, composing more classical music, and working on a Woolly Bully animated cartoon for television. And when last heard from, Rudy Martinez had a bean farm in Michigan. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease, research assistants from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif and Abby Fanta are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Over the years, we've been lucky enough on Fresh Air to have some great musicians perform on the show, like Dr. John, Alan Toussaint, Jay McShann, and Brave Combo. On the next Fresh Air, excerpts from our studio concerts. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.